thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to our series, Percolating on Faith with the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and of course, we have our two amazing guests, Tony and Charmaine Chavala-Smith. Hey, you two, thank you so much for coming back.
Hi, Carla. Good to be here. We're going to sound a little croaky today because we're both getting over colds. So,
but still, nevertheless, good to be here and glad we can do this.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Today's podcast was inspired by a sermon that I preached a couple weeks ago on the lectionary scripture of the day, which was Luke 18:1-8. It's a parable about the widow and the unjust judge, and it was a great sermon, if I do say so myself. In the sermon, I had two major points. One was persistence in praying, and the second was praying is about participating in something bigger than ourselves. So those were my two major big points. And then I had a couple minor points. Now, one of these minor points, and when I say it was a minor point, I mean it was like the smallest of minor points. I think I said one sentence on it. It was about faith and doubt and how I don't believe they're opposites. In fact, I think faith and certainty are more opposing than faith and doubt. Mm-hmm. Now, after the worship was over, people came up to talk to me about my sermon, and not one person mentioned my two big points, not one person, but about five or six people talked to me about that one sentence that I said about how I don't think that faith and doubt are opposites. And that's when I started to realize this is a pretty big deal for a lot of people. And I think that in some organizations that to doubt is probably a pretty big offense against their church. To doubt even a little means that you don't trust the leadership, that you're questioning the truth of the Bible, and I have truth in quotation marks, and so on. And it's it could be like a slippery slope all the way to dun 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 atheism or something like that. So I think we should talk about this. Is there room for doubt in one's faith tradition? If so, is it healthy? Is it unhealthy? I think that this is an important question for a lot of people. So let's talk about it. Faith and doubt.
Great topic.
Yeah, I think healthy faith isn't possible without doubt. Because it's kind of like the certainty thing that you were saying. If we think all we have is answers, there's no room to grow. There's no place else to go if you have all the answers. And then God stays just as big as wherever you started. And it's even in scripture itself, people ask the questions back to God, Moses was full of them, right? Mm-hmm. Well, so who do I say that you are, Not, oh yeah, yeah, but very much going deeper, figuring out more by asking the questions that say, we don't have it all.
There's a great passage at the end of Matthew's gospel. It's in what's called the Great Commission story or scene. And so it's after Easter, and the risen Christ appears to the 11 disciples on a mountain. And the text says that when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. And it's possible, roughly possible to translate that they worshiped him and they doubted. So in either case, you notice that the next thing Jesus doesn't say is, all right, doubters, off the boat. he does not send any of the doubters away. He simply sends them all out. And for me, that is a great image of Jesus welcoming among his disciples, his chosen disciples who are going to take the good news out beyond Palestine. those who have both trust in him and doubt.
I thought of a bit of a visual that I call it a faith continuum. And so if you imagine a line, and at one end is belief, and the other end is doubt, again, they're not opposites, but they are elements of faith. And throughout our lives, we move back and forth between them, sometimes strongly with belief, and sometimes strongly with doubt, but they both are important. It's like exercising. If you want to build strong muscles, on the one hand, you need to exercise, and on the other hand, you have to rest the muscles. And I think it's the same thing, that on the one hand, you have belief, and on the other hand, you have doubt. And the two are essential to have a faith that can go somewhere, that can and can go deeper.
So I think you're hearing us both say that doubt is a constitutive and necessary part of faith. And so in answer to your question, is it healthy? Well, yes, it's healthy. It's normal. It's part of faith. And trying to suppress doubt is what is unhealthy and leads to all kinds of unhealthy and negative behaviors in churches.
I was just reading a kid's book this morning. Actually, I was finishing it up because book club is this afternoon. And there was actually a quote in it that really fits, and it's from James Thurber. And the book is called Wonder. It's a great book. But this is a little quote. "It is better to know some of the questions than all of the answers."
Oh, I like that a lot.
I do too.
So it does sound like we're all on board with this idea that faith and doubt are not opposites, that doubt is healthy in growing. But I want to back it up just a little bit to make sure that we're all on the same page with this. How do you define the word faith?
So that's a really good place to go. I think there's a common misconception among a lot of churchgoers that faith is actually a mental act in which you agree to 12, 15, or 35 propositions, most of which actually seem impossible to you.
Yeah.
In other words, that faith is about having a certain kind of agreement with a certain set of data, a certain set of things that are claimed to be facts or true. But what's really interesting is that kind of the pioneer of faith in the Bible is Paul, and that is not his understanding of faith. So if we look at letters like Romans and Galatians, where faith is a central topic, and especially I'm thinking of Romans chapter 4, where Paul retells the Abraham story, you know, the promise made to Abram and Sarai, you get a clearer sense of what faith was for Paul. And in that text, God makes this, you know, outrageous promise to Abraham and Sarah about having offspring. And the text says that Abraham trusted, even though he was good as dead. In other words, for Paul, and I think at its best in the Bible as a whole, faith is a kind of in spite of trust or a nevertheless trust that calls out of you your whole self. So let me just say then that for me, faith is radical, self-transcending trust, meaning it's when we entrust ourselves to something that is beckoning to us or calling to us in spite of all evidence to the contrary or in spite of the struggles and risk entailed in that. So in a technical theological sense, you could call it ecstatic trust. Ecstatic, you're meaning an outside of a trust you give that's outside of the normal parameters of how you function in everyday life. It's not unlike falling in love with somebody, where there's an element of entrusting yourself wholly to this other person, in spite of the risk. And so there's that element in faith too.
So I think I would answer it, the question of what is faith, in a kind of, again, probably a more visual way. And I think about water. And I think about how we take water in, and it nourishes us, and it's in us. It's a part of ourselves. It's a part of who we are, whether we recognize it or not. Water, in large bodies of water, water holds us up and lets us float. But my experience is that faith is not linear. It's not just intellect or head stuff, but it's kind of built into all the different layers and dimensions of who we are. Faith, I guess in the shortest form, would be accepting God's presence. And maybe that's just it, accepting God's presence, just like we take in water, acknowledging that God is at work all around us and in us. It's in our memories, in our relationships, in moments of beauty or creativity. It's lodged in our intuitions and our imaginations, and our probably, and I'd say our deepest desires too.
Faith, wow.
Yeah. Well, faith. Faith is just it's not so definable or measurable, because it's in the deeper parts of who we are, not just a set of ideas, like Tony said. Though those are a piece of it, but a small piece, and that's actually the part that can change most easily, the ideas. And the other parts of faith, those ones that are woven into us, are usually quite resilient and quite trustworthy. But they can change too, because it's on that experiential level. When we encounter mystery, that informs who we are as well. And then the things that we thought we knew, or the things that we, the experiences we had interpreted in a particular way, they shift too. And because mystery makes us humble and mm-hmm. willing to let go of some things. And that can also make us feel panicked at times. Just be honest.
Sure.
But often that actually helps us rely on some of the other aspects of faith as well, on community and on wise individuals who are not afraid of the questions, or afraid of our doubt, or afraid of this new pathway we're not sure where it's headed yet. So anyhow, it's a kind of a different way of looking at faith, but for me, anyhow, it kind of describes, all those things that people have given me over my life that helped me know a real and living God, a present Jesus, and helped me understand what it is when the Spirit moves around me, and those are the roots, I think, of faith. And so they're distributed all through our lives.
Well, those are some pretty intense definitions of a small word like faith.
A little esoteric, perhaps.
No, I liked it. I actually wrote down some of the things that you said. So Tony, I really appreciated when you said it's radical self-transcending trust. Radical self-transcending trust. That's pretty huge. And Charmaine, I appreciated it when you said you talked about it's just really just an acceptance of God's presence. Like those are two ideas that I can really sink my teeth into. But while you were talking, I started thinking about the phrase, like I've lost my faith, or I'm losing my faith. And I started wondering about maybe where that came from. And I wanted to go back to that first idea that I said about faith and certainty maybe being opposites. Do you think that when someone says I've lost my faith, it could be perhaps because they were based in certainty rather than in faith? or something like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sometimes we confuse, let's say, the sociological framework in which we're experiencing faith with faith itself. So in other words, we experience the regularities of church and worship and certain words being said and certain things being said. And I definitely believe those are important, but sometimes we confuse faith as this you know, radical relationship of self-transcending trust. We can confuse that with the trappings or the externals of the religious tradition that's forming us. And so if questions get raised about, you know, our church's history, or why are we doing this? Maybe we should do it differently, that kind of thing. Then sometimes what happens is that creates a sort of a strange tremor in the force, and we confuse the doubt that arises from that with somehow a loss of faith. I don't think the appearance of doubt means per se the loss of faith.
I like the question a lot, because for lots of people, the sense of losing faith is often a feeling, and it's because things have shifted, and it's like going into a new city or a new landscape, and you're not exactly sure where it's safe to stand and whether or not to make eye contact, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of. And so when sometimes spiritual growth and puts us in places that are unfamiliar to us, and so when our feelings aren't calm and settled, we often, or if we aren't able to sense God in the ways that we have in the past, in congregation life, where we think like everybody else, and then suddenly to be in a place where we may be thinking differently or asking different questions. Sometimes the feeling of loss of faith is really more about feeling shifting mm-hmm. than it is about anything being lost. In fact, it may be that you're on the doorstep of some deepening spiritually.
Yeah, I like that. I like the idea that in our faith journeys, we have times when the landmarks mm-hmm. no longer become reliable, or the landmarks disappear, and we're left in this place where we can't sense God, we can't believe in God, we can't feel God. But you know, at least in American culture, I think Christian faith and Christian spiritualities are way too heavily dependent upon feeling as a guide. In other words, if I'm feeling really good today, then my faith is certain. It's like, no, that's your momentary emotional feeling of certainty, and you better not confuse it with what faith is. I'm very much indebted to the 20th century Lutheran theologian Paul Tillich, who identifies faith as ultimate concern, as being ultimately concerned about something that is infinitely important. And you can remain ultimately concerned about God even if you cannot feel, sense, or be aware of God's presence in any way, even if you go through one of those long, dark, difficult periods where God seems completely absent. From Tillich's perspective, remaining ultimately concerned about where you are going and connecting to the infinite still is an act of faith. So that for me is very helpful.
So Charmaine, you were talking about maybe in those moments when we feel like we're losing our faith, or when something feels different, maybe what is necessary is maybe like changing our image of God or something like that. You know, knowing maybe something is breaking open, something is moving forward.
Exactly. It may be an invitation to going deeper rather than a loss of anything. Though, you know, to gain new things, we have to open our hands and let go of what we had there before. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's sometimes difficult too. And so there is loss, but following a path of curiosity and inquiry and questioning, I don't think we need to be afraid of it. A way of thinking about it, especially about changing ideas about God, is is that what we're taught about God is not God. It may be some characteristics of God, maybe, descriptive of aspects of God. And as we've talked about in a previous podcast, sometimes our the people that we look up to in our churches only tell us those parts of God that they think they can control us with. I think we talked about that one on the one on sex. And so who God is so much more, so much bigger than what we're taught about God. And the only way to really explore all of that is to do, to be open like God is open. God is open to us and self-revealing. And I think that's what God asks of us too, is to be open and vulnerable and to let who God is attach to more aspects of our lives. So anyhow, that's another way of looking at it, that faith is not something or beliefs are not something static, that because what can we know about God? Well, we can know bits and pieces, and the rest are there for us to keep learning about.
I think there is such a thing as broken faith, mm-hmm. where the negative side of that is that we have perhaps put our trust in the wrong things. And for me, that my experience with that in my early 20s was after I had joined what then was the Reorganized Church, now Community of Christ, and I learned all of the old stuff, all of the old theology of the Reorganized Church. I learned it really well and really quickly and gave myself completely to it and, thought Joseph Smith Jr. was the next best thing to Jesus, and on it went, and had all these images and visions of how the church was and how things ought to be. And what happened was that I discovered, little by little, that those pictures were false pictures, false in the sense that they were not complete, and that I had put my trust in a set of symbols and stories in a way that I shouldn't have. And that created a really difficult period in my life. Because on the one hand, there was this awareness that I had been encountered by the love and mercy and grace of God in this tradition. And yet at the same time, I was aware that the way people locally where I joined the church were talking about the tradition was simply not historically complete or accurate, and that some of the theological claims really, when you take the big view of Christian faith, were kind of way off base. And so, you have this sense of tension between an awareness that you have encountered the holy and want to give yourself to it, and the other side of it where you realize that oh, gee, the expressions of that I have given myself to are way, way, way off base or less than complete. What do you do with that? And so that was a real, and that's actually part of the theological journey, isn't it? So that very, very much formed me. And now as I look back, I see that period of doubt and confusion was a way of freeing me from a certain kind of idolatry, right? A certain way of holding a set of ideas, beliefs, historical statements, and so on, as absolutes, when in fact they were partials, not absolutes. So periods of doubt actually can help us learn truly and deeply and really to trust in the real God, and not the gods we make up.
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe it really in that way really does make it sound like it, when you fall in love. You know, you fall in love and everything about that person is fantastic and wonderful and they're so wonderful. And then you realize they never hang up their towels. And you just want to hurt them in a really harsh, hard way. And so it sounds like faith is like taking off the rose-colored glasses, you know, getting those rose-colored glasses off and seeing what's really there rather than what we think is there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's true. And I think, it was the great Swiss reformer, John Calvin, who said this. I loved this statement he makes about human beings. He says, we human beings are a perpetual factory of idols. I love that. Idols are finite things we create, and then we demand ultimate trust towards them. And they're not God. And so religious claims, denominational trappings, and so on, these are not, as Charmaine said, she said it very clearly, these are less thans. But we like to worship the less thans because we can control them, and we can have certainty about them. And so in some respects, certainty is more connected to idolatry than it is connected to real faith.
Yeah, so now we're back to that certainty thing. So we found maybe a connection with where it comes in with faith and doubt, and it's kind of like that place where the rose-colored glasses are still on. That's because that feels comfortable, that feels safe, and at last you said we can control it. Tony, I want to go back to what you said about Paul Tillich's ultimate concern.
Yeah.
I don't know if I totally understand what you mean. Can you give like an example about it, or can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So this is a little book of Paul Tillich's I would recommend. It's called The Dynamics of Faith. This is a classic exposition of what do we mean by faith, given by one of the great 20th century modern Protestant theologians. And he's trying to understand what faith is, how to talk about it in philosophical terms that would make sense to modern people. So ultimate concern is his way of describing faith as this complete giving of oneself, the whole self, mind, spirit, body, etc., but giving of the whole self to something that one perceives as holy or ultimate. In other words, it's to radically, ultimately give yourself to that which you perceive as ultimate. And then, Tillich analyzes this and he says, we human beings have a tendency to give ourselves to things that are ultimate that turn out not to be. And so he does some analyzing of that. This is where he talks about, he contrasts faith and doubt here and says that basically doubt is a further expression of real faith, because he says if you have in a situation of doubt, Tillich says, even doubt about God, it doesn't have to separate us from God, because there's faith present in every serious doubt. Even if it's merely faith that there is some truth I've not yet grasped yet, that's still faith. That's still an ultimate drawing you on. Giving oneself to the quest for truth, for Tillich, is an expression of ultimate concern. Sometimes that quest for truth will lead us to break radically with parts of our past. It'll lead us to critique our traditions and so on. But getting back to where we started, Charmaine's sliding scale kind of thing, her line.
Continuum, yeah.
So because we are finite creatures and we are trying to relate to that which is infinite, we can't help but have uncertainty or doubt. We are not infinite. And so ultimate concern is our giving of ourselves fully and completely to that which we perceive to be ultimate. Sometimes those ultimates turn out to be false ultimates, like the nation or the flag or, I don't know, mom and apple pie, whatever, money, the pursuit of success. We love to give ourselves completely to things. That's part of our kind of religious constitution as human beings. But we also have a pretty bad track record when it comes to giving ourselves to the wrong things and making ultimates of them and giving ourselves ultimately to them. So anyway, that's kind of a, I don't know if that helps clarify at all.
It absolutely does. Thank you so much for that. So we've talked a lot about faith. We've defined it. We've talked about what certain people think about it. Let's talk a little bit more about doubt and like, what are the positive aspects of doubt? Like, why is it so important? Why should it actually be part of our religious experience rather than, you know, get rid of it completely?
The good things about doubt, one is that it allows us to be honest with ourselves. That A, we don't know everything, and B, we can't know everything. And that means that questions are welcome, that uncertainty is an invitation to discovery. And the other part about doubt, especially when it comes to faith, is that sense that God is, as Tony had said earlier, God is not within our capacity to fully understand. And I think about, you know, when I was in high school and I had a lot of questions about this whole religious thing. And, you know, I absorbed pretty well what I could about the church's belief and Christianity in general. But there were some things that didn't make any sense at all. And, you know, views of Genesis that said this was exactly 7 days and this is how creation happened. And, you know, my learning science made me say, well, that doesn't make sense. And of course, then, you know, immediately after that comes the feeling of, oh my gosh, am I not being faithful if I don't believe what some people have told me? And I think over time I realized, well, some people might not see it as faithful, but the only way I was going to figure out who God was for me, I had to move from inheriting somebody else's faith to defining my own. And that means engagement. And doubt is often the thing that helps us see where we need to search next. So, you know, at the same time, this isn't when I was in grade 12, at the same time that my mind is flip-flopping back and forth of, well, if there is a God, then what, you know, what does that mean for me? What do I want to do with my life if there's a God? And then on the other side saying, but I can totally see how people who don't believe in God can see how creation came to be. And that's, you know, there's some logic there as well. And my mind flipping back and forth between these two things. And eventually, because then that helps you look, right? It helps you look for other kinds of answers. And to doubt actually allows you to value faith more. I'm thinking of that time in my life. It was my balance. I could explore, I could think about where science and science questions took me, but I also had this other reality that though it was changing my understanding of God, it also held me so that I could explore. I don't know if that makes sense, but doubt gave me empathy for others. Doubt said, there's some questions I don't understand. Doubt said, I need to explore this because I think probably there are other Christians out there who have found peace with the idea of what does it mean that God is creator or what does it mean that God knows me? But science doesn't, you know, what science would say about creation is different. So it opened up all kinds of doors for me, both in my relationship with God and in my understandings of things. So So I think doubt is really crucial.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, I think for people who have been shaped by modern and postmodern thought, science often poses really significant questions for faith. I don't think that they are ultimately destructive of faith, but you have to take those questions seriously. And when you realize that you can, in some ways, make reasonable sense of the world independently of religion or theology, it ought to cause a little bit of doubt and make you want to, as a theologian, do it better then, right? So,
right. And, you know, I was just thinking the other day, a very, very dear friend of mine from Australia, my Australian mom, actually, Wendy Ballards, once said to me, she said, everyone needs a conversion experience. And I don't know if that's exactly what we're talking about here, but Charmaine, when you said we need to go from inheriting someone else's faith to defining our own, it sounds like in the middle of those things is a little conversion experience. We have to decide, this is what my faith looks like. This is how I see God and how I feel God and how I know God. And has to be different than the way my mom does, or my Sunday school teacher does, or my pastor does, because I'm a different person. My faith might look completely different, even though it could be similar as well. Does that make sense? Does that sound right?
Yeah, because, you know, we can't, our relationship with God, the basis of our faith, can't be determined by someone else's experiences or understanding or connections to God. And God seems pretty generous about meeting us where we are. You know, in that time in grade 12, at the same time as I was saying, well, I'm not sure if God is even really real or if God really was the creator, I was also praying that God would help me know what one of my purposes in life might be, and planning my life for an answer. So so it's, I think when I got past that time and actually did have some sense of an answer of how I could grow in God and had some tasks before me, I look back and it's like, wait a minute, God didn't reject me because I had doubts. In fact, it's exactly in the doubts and the questions that God met me. And so there was that sense that God can use us exactly in the middle of our doubts. And we may be even more useful and more open during those times.
Yeah, I think that those times create that virtue that seems often lacking in lots of Christianity, which is humility. Humility before the mystery of God, and humility before what we don't know, and humility before the things that we do. You know, I mean, it's Paul in 1 Corinthians 13, you know, says we see in part. You know, we see enough to give ourselves ultimately to, but it's all partial knowledge. So why should we be afraid of that? And why should churches pretend that they have ultimate knowledge when they don't? It creates all kinds of pastoral and spiritual problems for people.
And this might be exactly why certainty is so dangerous, because when you say, I know something is true and I know that this is right, that almost always puts someone on the other side of the line in the wrong. So when you say, I know this is right, in some ways, it seems like what you're saying is that I have the answers. You don't have the answers. God, my faith is stronger than your faith. So that's not where God wants us to be either.
Right. Right. And in some of the same ways that we can misuse certainty or make certainty our God, we have to be honest that there are some dangers to doubt too, but they're probably not the ones we usually think about or hear about in hymns or sermons saying, don't doubt. But a couple of dangers of doubt that I'm aware of, and Tony and I get to see in various settings, one of them is that people who are going through their times of doubt and embracing it, and it's becoming this empowering thing for them personally, maybe intellectually, but in their relationship with God, Sometimes they can inadvertently and sometimes intentionally use the doubts and the questions to shock other people or it's kind of like, if I have to go through this time of doubt, you're going with me, kind of thing. and trying to shock other people or undermine or use it like a power tool. Did you know this and this and this? And that can be dangerous because, in a way, it's making doubt the new answers, the new way, the new God. And so that's the other part of it, is that sometimes because doubting and the exploration and excitement that come with it can be intoxicating as well, we may want to stay there. And there is a kind of power that comes with knowing the questions and being able to startle other people with things they haven't thought of yet. And that's a danger because of what it does to the body of Christ, what it does to others' relationships with God, because then we're not respecting where they are on their journey, and we're still, again, like with certainty, saying that, well, I'm superior to you, and the path that I'm on is better than yours. So that's something I think for us to be honest about, too, is that doubt and questions can become power tools that can be misused.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like doubt. When doubt becomes the new certainty,
yes,
it becomes an idol, too. and the quest is to move on, right? We need to keep, you know, it's not for nothing that in the New Testament, in the Gospel of Luke in particular, Christianity is called the path, because that means, you know, it's a path because you walk on it. You don't just stop on it, right?
And though nobody in your congregation, when you gave the sermon that you mentioned at the beginning, got it, this is one of those places where being persistent in prayer is the best antidote to letting doubt become your driver, your tyrant, is to keep grounded in, like I was saying, those other dimensions of faith. So even as you're exploring some areas, you're valuing and reaffirming these other levels of other layers of faith in your life. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for bringing it back to that amazing sermon I gave. I really appreciate that.
I thought I'd get a couple points on that one.
You truly did. So, in your last, in the last part that you said, you talked about the stages of faith. Do we want to talk a little bit about the stages of faith and where doubt may or may not come in?
Yeah, I know that there are lots of different books that try to create or identify certain stages. Like faith goes through this, and then it goes through this, and then it goes through this. Can I just say I'm sometimes a little skeptical of typologies like that, just because they can, because then what can happen is, I've seen this happen before. You know, it's like you say, there's four stages to the fourth journey, or to the faith journey, and at stage four is this union with God and blah blah blah, and then inevitably in a group of people you'll get some who'll say, I am so glad I'm at stage four. I see that you're at stage three.
Yeah.
Or one.
So the stage thing can be a little bit.
But there is that whole the idea of, you know, kind of that first phase of innocent faith or absorbing all that's around you, and. And then there's the sense of the tension that comes when those that faith or those ideas no longer meet the need of the person and perhaps the circumstances they are in. And so there becomes this time of questioning, or a term we used in the class yesterday for history of, or community of Christ theology, was the idea of demythologizing this time where you start to take things apart and look at them, analyze them in new ways. And that often happens for people who have begun with faith early in their lives. That often is happening in junior high, high school, and as young adults, as the reality that we now encounter and the early faith that we had, they don't blend well, they don't mesh well, and we realize that if we're going to have faith, it's going to have to be a more resilient faith, a more expansive faith. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that's a really crucial time for people to be able to embrace the idea that doubt is good, that asking questions is healthy, and also to know that they have a community who supports them, so that they won't get too far astray without someone kind of putting an arm around them and drawing them back, you know, a little bit. So there is that time of, we called it yesterday demythologizing, but sometimes it's called disillusionment. And that is the point, though, at which people's own faith, not their inherited faith, has room to take hold. But again, it's a tender faith. Mm-hmm. Because the pieces are new and we don't really know how they all fit together securely, and not sure if we want them to fit together that securely, because we don't want that to become the new set in stone thing we're going to have to break apart later. So, you know, community is really huge during that time. And then there's the idea of coming to a new kind of confidence in your faith, but with open doors in your faith. Mm-hmm. And embracing some of the things that if someone were to hear you talk about them, they might think you were back at the earliest stage, the childish stage. But this is called the second naivete. And this is where some of those things that you learned at the first, you value again, not in the same way as you first did, but the truths that they held, you can embrace again. Not going back on the questions and the new insights, but embracing them in a new and deeper way. So anyhow, I don't know if that makes sense.
I think that's a good corrective to my reactiveness towards typologies or systems like that. And actually, the analogy that I did with students might be useful here, and that is that, you know, take the analogy of Santa Claus, for example,
yeah,
and Christmas. And as a little kid, you know, you're completely captivated, enchanted by the story of Santa Claus, or you may be, sorry, I was as a little kid, and you know, you totally believe in the story. And then at some point, eventually, maybe,
probably
at some point, you realize, oh wait, it's mom or dad, or mom and dad, or grandma and grandpa. You know, they're actually Santa Claus, and it's just, and then you go through this. It's just a story stage, and it's like, sometimes at that point, the disillusionment is that, oh, geez, my parents have been lying to me all these years.
Right. This is also one of those places where this whole idea of the dangers of doubt come in, too, because it's like when kids get to that point, it's like I have a new power tool, and they want to disillusion everyone else. They want to tell their little brothers and sisters, I know something you don't know.
Right.
And, they want them to hurt as much, you know.
Yeah,
as they
we actually heard of from one of our students who has grown kids, that one of her kids, when he realized that the Santa Claus story was just a story, basically slipped mom and dad a note and said, I know, and I'm going to tell my younger sister if you don't give me this. It was kind of like a hostage taking situation.
Oh my goodness, gosh!
But the parents actually, I just want to. The parents slipped a note then under his door and said, "If you tell, you don't get any presents."
Oh yes.
But then going on to that third stage, I mean, you can stay the rest of your life, you know, disenchanted and disgruntled about Santa Claus, or in the third stage, you might say, wait a second, I just took a history of Christian thought class and discovered there was a Saint Nicholas in what is today Turkey in the 4th century, a bishop we know very little about. But what little we do know about this bishop from the 4th century is that he raised money as a church leader to try to provide poor girls dowries so that they wouldn't be sold by their families into slavery. And then you can begin to say, look, the Santa Claus story always had this deeper truth in it. That is that Christmas and St. Nicholas and Santa Claus and all that, behind that is this radical call to act justly on behalf of the powerless. And then Christmas can be re-enchanted for you at a whole new level. And so that's what, you know, Charmaine's using the phrase, the second naivete. And you come to be critically minded but naive again, and you move beyond that critical stage where you want to pop everybody else's faith balloon, and then move on to, actually, there's something profoundly true here, and I'm going to hang in with that and even try to grow in that. So that's where the faith journey wants to take us.
That's a really great example. And I actually thought you were going to go to the idea of, like, if you were to become a parent, you could jump back into the belief in Santa Claus with your children, you know, yeah. But that's also probably part of it, but maybe not.
Yeah, it could be. That's a great analogy. Mm-hmm.
So we are coming close to the end of our time, but I really wanted to see if you guys had any tips for people who still struggle with the word doubt and who still struggle with doubting themselves and think that it's a really bad thing to doubt. What are some, do you have any tips to help those people through this situation, or a way to maybe look at it in a different way? We've had a lot of conversation about it. I just wanted to see if we could kind of wrap it up in this way. How could we help some people?
Well, I do know that there are some people who are, it's a deeply ingrained fear of doubt. And it means not loving God or not trusting God. And so I guess there's a couple things that I'd written down weeks ago that I think might be helpful here. One is that as you trust God with the uncertainties, and so I'm trying to avoid the word doubt here. So with the uncertainties, and letting God be with you in the uncertainties, to keep affirming faith, the faith that is in you. Because then as you value it and affirm it, you're not so afraid that you're going to lose it. So, you know, revisit your experiences with God. And maybe in that, recognize there could be multiple meanings and there's lots of dimensions to look at. Keep praying and worshiping and being open to God and be part of a community, a community especially that is willing to ask the hard questions too. So here's an image to think about. It's like instead of thinking of faith and doubt, another way of looking at it might be stabilizing faith and adventurous or exploring faith. So there's like these two kinds of faith at work in us. And the image is the stabilizing faith is kind of like floating on, you know, in a pool or on a lake. We know how to float, and that's a safe place for us to be, and we can enjoy the water. Again, the idea of the water being God. And we can value that, but we can also value that there's this other kind of faith at work in us that wants to explore. And that faith takes us below the surface. It lets questions and curiosity about God and about the world take us down deeper. And in the process, we have to learn how to breathe, right? We have to learn how to breathe on the surface, and we have to learn that we can take a breath and it will be enough to sustain us in the questioning, in the exploration, and that we always can come back to the surface and rest on the surface in that stabilizing faith, but that there's more to discover and there's more to see and feel and know about God. So anyhow, it was a kind of an exciting idea when I first thought about it, and there's lots of all kinds of analogy things you can go with it. But I thought, you know, that in some ways it's just the other side of faith, doubt. The wanting to go deeper, to explore.
And I just say amen to that. I love that image, and it's an amazing journey. When I am in doubting moods and so on, what helps me a lot is going back to the Gospel of Mark. Because the disciples in the Gospel of Mark are a strange mixture of trust, doubt, and sheer stupidity. And I can kind of relate to all of that.
I think that we can all relate to that, actually. Because we are all those things all at the same time. I sometimes think about being a yo-yo, and that God's finger is, you know, and I go up and down on this yo-yo all the time. That, you know, I just wish sometimes the string was really, really short so that I didn't have to move all the time and continually be thinking and praying and trying to figure this out. But it's the times when I feel far away that I recognize that how good it is when I'm close, and how important it is for me to be close and to figure those things out. And it's always when I'm away that I learn the most about who I am and who my faith is and who my faith is in. So, yeah. Gosh, well, thank you for those, for that analogy.
Yeah. And I have one last, quote that is from, Proper Confidence. It's the name of the book is Proper Confidence: Faith, Doubt, and Certainty in Christian Discipleship by Leslie Newbegin. And here's the quote: "One does not learn anything except by believing something. And conversely, if one doubts everything, one learns nothing. On the other hand, believing everything uncritically is the road to disaster. The faculty of doubt is essential. But as I have argued, rational doubts always rest on faith, and not vice versa. The relationship between the two cannot be reversed."
Yeah. Amen.
Ooh. Well, thank you for reading that quote. I appreciate that quote very much, although there's a lot to unpack there as well.
There is. But it talks about how essential doubt is. The doubt that rests on faith is a doubt we can trust.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good one. So is there anything else that you want to say that you didn't get a chance to say, that something that popped into your head and you're like, oh, I have to come back to that, and we didn't get back to that?
Let's see. I can't think of anything for me. Charmaine is thinking.
No, just the last thing would just be, in a society that is often polarized over many things, to resist putting faith and doubt as polar opposites. Mm. It's not all or nothing. It never is. And as long as the reason we're doubting is for the health of our faith, we're okay.
Yeah, I really appreciated that idea of a faith continuum with doubt on one side and belief on the other, and moving back and forth on that continuum. I really appreciated that. So thank you, Tony and Charmaine, for your thoughts. And I appreciate, as always, your wisdom and your guidance. And I'm already looking forward to our next podcast.
Well, thank you. We're so glad we could do this. And so glad that our colds haven't impeded this too much, though just a little. You've heard us probably coughing and wheezing in the background.
It just adds that little something that we don't always get.
Well, we're very, very glad we could be part of this.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.